I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, John Meacham, has been with us on previous books that he has written. He has spent 10 years and did numerous interviews with his subject, who happened to be the 41st president of the U.S., George Herbert Walker Bush. And John's latest book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. He and Barbara Bush cooperated with this project, and John writes that he was willing, the former president, to spend as much time as John needed to talk about his life. And then Jeb Bush and George W. Bush and Marvin and Neil and Dora all agreed to do interviews as well. John says his main aim in the book was to paint a biographical portrait of the 41st president and attempt to give readers a sense of a singular and complicated man whose life and career spans so much of our history. And indeed it does. And he had parts of his life that probably many of us have forgotten, or because he didn't brag a lot about himself, we weren't very familiar with some of his, for instance, World War II heroism. John is a contributing editor at Time. He's executive vice president and executive editor at Random House, and he is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. He's author of American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Biography in 2009. He's also the author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship, and American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him as we talk about our 41st president. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. John Meacham, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
You must miss, after all of those years, don't you miss not having a lot of interviews? Or maybe you still have them with our 41st president. That's a long time.
It was a long time. As he put it, we were almost going steady for a while. So it was several times a year. I would go mostly to Houston, go to Maine, but there were more distractions in Maine. So Houston was an easier place to interview him. And it was really a remarkable journey. He was willing to talk as much as I wanted. He made his diaries, audio diary from the White House years and his vice presidential years available. Mrs. Bush shared her diary from 1948 forward. And so it was a remarkable experience as a biographer.
It is remarkable as you read the book to realize how long he's lived and the great variety of experiences he's had, John. I want to start simply because I didn't know very much about this, and I find the World War II generation interesting. I had no idea how young he was when he was a bomber pilot, how he almost, I mean, he came so close to losing his life, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. No, he signed up to join the Navy on his 18th birthday, the same day he graduated from high school. It was June 12, 1942. And he had even considered going into the Royal Canadian Air Force in December, right after Pearl Harbor, because you could get in faster. But ultimately, he was prevailed upon to graduate from high school. He was 20 when he was shot down over the Pacific after taking out a tower on an island called Chichijima. Lost two crewmates. One of the many moments when he broke down emotionally when we were talking was as he recalled those two men. And he was driven, my argument is that to some extent his drive is attributable to his always wanting to answer the question, why was I spared? Mm-hmm. Why was I lucky enough to live? And what he was going to do with that life once it had been granted him.
You asked him when he was in his 80s, did he ever dream about Chichijima, and what did he say?
He said, dream, no, well, maybe, which means yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's clear that he did. I mean, he, before he was 30, I mean, here's another way of thinking about it. He had more intimate contact with life and death than many of us ever do, because he and Mrs. Bush lost a daughter to leukemia in 1953. So before he was you know, he was 29 years old. He had had the wartime experience. He'd lost a child to cancer. Just a much more complex and interesting figure than most people think.
Mm-hmm. And you, this almost makes the reader of your book cry. Years later, you write that he went to Poland. Was it Poland he went to?
Mm-hmm.
And he went to a ward where there were children with leukemia, and he saw this young boy who was 9 years old, and he just started sobbing. And, I mean, the story takes a lot of dimensions. So tell us that story.
Well, he won't turn around. The press is behind him. To me, it's a fascinating moment and a revelatory one. He is in Krakow. He goes to this leukemia ward. The press pool with cameras and is behind him. And he won't turn around, because if he turns around, it will make the story about him and not about them. And, you know, I know a lot of politicians. You know a lot of politicians. I don't know many of them who would not have turned around and manufactured a kind of moment out of that, but George Bush was not going to do it.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting you use that phrase "turn around," because even though he experienced some horrendous things in life, he didn't turn around, did he? You keep looking forward. You keep going on.
Absolutely, the code was always on to the next thing. Very WASPy, very New England. But also Western. That's the interesting thing about it. What makes the story transcendent is that you can see so much of our history through him. The two families, the Bushes and the Walkers, that produced him were both Midwestern families. Mm-hmm. One from Columbus, Ohio. One from St. Louis. They came east in 1920, more or less, and then he has a Greenwich childhood and a New England childhood. But the moment he can, which is the summer of 1948, he moves to Texas to get into the oil business, just as the center of gravity in the country is moving south and west.
Hmm.
So you can see him, you can see in him the shifting tides of American power.
Mm-hmm. And he could have had, you write about this quite a bit, this pretty cushy life. You know, he had all these mm-hmm. connections, could have been an investment banker, making a lot on the golf course all the time. But he didn't go that route.
He wanted it to, as he put it to me, it wasn't different enough. He couldn't, as he put it, make his own goals, make his own way. He knew that if he went to Wall Street, he would be in the shadow of his father, who was a Brown Brothers Harriman, and his grandfather, who was a G.H. Walker and Company. And he, as he wrote in a letter to a friend at the time, he didn't want to just take advantage of the fact that he'd gone to the same debutante parties as possible clients. He didn't want to just raise money for investments, and wanted to do something that was more adventurous. I think part of that was the war, because, of course, he'd fought in the war before this chapter in his life. There was a certain code in the Bush Walker family that though you had immense support from the family, to be clear, you were respected in proportion to how well you did out in the world, more or less on your own. Mm-hmm. You had to take risks, and that established a certain amount of respect within the clan.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the competition in his early family. His mom was, but not willy-nilly competition. It was something that pushed you, that tested you. That it was, if you can use this phrase, competition with a purpose.
It was. It was a very muscular Christianity, Victorian way of looking at the world. Athletics, competition were all a measure of character. The pursuit of excellence was a pursuit that you undertook as naturally as the air you breathed. She was a tough woman, Dorothy Walker Bush, by all accounts, an extraordinary one. People swoon over her even 20 years after her death now, 23 years after her death. But she she once broke her wrist while playing in a tennis match, finished the match, and won. I mean, this is a tough woman.
Yes.
She expected him, but there's a little detail deep in the files about a reminiscence of the president's, about she expected the children to climb as high as they could in the trees outside the house. And as President Bush described it, she never actually told them to do it, but somehow or another, she communicated the expectation. And once a neighbor came over and said, you know, Mrs. Bush, I think that might be dangerous. And she said, well, they have to learn sometime. This is a woman who learned how to swim at Walker's Point in the Atlantic Ocean in Maine by having one of her Walker uncles just throw her in and see if she could swim. You know, it's just a tough, tough crowd.
Right.
And with a competing imperative, which is modesty and humility, at least rhetorically. She is famous for not having, for saying, you know, don't talk about the great I am. Don't be a braggadocio. No one wants to hear about yourself, you know. And her son imbued, you know, sort of in, you know, took in both these lessons. You know, fight, 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 succeed, 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 but don't talk about it. And so I think one of the reasons he was less than articulate on occasion is because he was hearing his mother's voice saying, oh, come on, don't talk about yourself so much.
Interesting. And his dad was a U.S. senator and a golfing buddy of Ike's.
Yep, he was Ike's favorite golfing partner, I think because he was the best golfer in the Senate. Prescott Bush was a phenomenally good golfer. It's also in sort of revealing, Eisenhower liked it that Prescott Bush never wanted to talk business and would never leak what had happened, what they had said. And so the Bush code of discretion was clearly in play even then.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Bush being more of a Ike kind of Republican than a Reagan kind of Republican. What do you mean?
Well, he was a moderate conservative, Bush was. He had more in common with Eisenhower and Ford than he did with Goldwater and Reagan and even his own son. Moderate conservatives were those who wanted to manage change as it came more or less organically, did not believe in astonishing transformations, believed that the, you know, things that were sudden and visionary could unleash forces that were ultimately uncontrollable. Movement conservatives wanted to take conservative ideas and be proactive with them. You cannot imagine a Bush revolution in the way a Reagan revolution took shape. So in that sense, I think Bush had far more in common with Eisenhower, who came in after the New Deal and the Fair Deal. And to the disappointment of many conservatives, even in the 1950s, did not launch a frontal assault against what FDR and Truman had built. Instead, he accepted that it was now part of the fabric of American life and attempted to manage it as opposed to transform it.
Mm. His line of public service positions is really phenomenal, and I'm wondering, did he get some of that from his dad? Did his dad say, hey, y'all ought to go into politics? Because it wasn't always easy for him. He didn't win all of these elections, but he kept going and kept going. Because why? Duty, honor, country? Something like that?
I think you've nailed several of the reasons. I think he was driven by an ethic of service. But as I said to him once, you know, if it were only service, you could have opened a soup kitchen. You know, he sought ultimate authority in a nuclear age. And so one of the key things about him was he was, in fact, emulating his father, who was the moderator. Before he was a senator, he was the moderator of the town meeting in Greenwich, which impressed itself significantly on all the Bush children because they were little, and he would come home and then go out to sort of run the town a little bit, preside over the town's affairs. And he, you know, he always had a sense that what you were supposed to do is make money so you would be independent and then go into public service, because that's exactly what his father had done. And before he was 40, he'd run for the Senate, trying to... Now, was that in competition with his father? I don't think so. I think he was just inspired by him to try to get up there. And as he put it to me, you know, why not try for the Senate, try to do things there? So he was never driven by a consuming ideology. He was never driven by specific ideas about politics or public policy. He was driven by an instinct to be a guardian, to be a steward, to manage things on behalf of the on behalf of the many, in a gracious and understated way.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at some issues that he was involved in a variety of political positions. I found this interesting, John, as a Texas Republican, because there's so much current talk about immigration, et cetera, and what the Republican Party needs to do to win the presidency again. As a Texas Republican, you're right, he was concerned about the future impact of his state's Hispanic population and praised the Political Association of Spanish-Speaking Organizations for its goal of registering 1 million new voters in Texas.
Yep, yep, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yes,
some things
it is.
Never change.
I know.
Never he was also very involved in Planned Parenthood, which is another example of sort of history may not repeat itself, but it does rhyme, as Mark Twain said. So what you had in him was someone who believed in a bigger tent. He almost immediately began trying to reach out to African Americans when he became the chairman of the Harris County Republican Party back in 1962. There are letters he wrote to various African American leaders in Houston trying to make Republicans competitive with them, because that voting bloc was already shifting. Mm-hmm. And so he was, he was always a man of the center. He uncomfortably took positions to the right, but he was never particularly comfortable with them. I think he was a moderate conservative. His basic instinct was the private sector should do it if it possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
It's unimaginable now that he would be nominated by the Republican
yes.
Party as it's currently constituted.
Yeah.
Unimaginable.
So on African-Americans, explain why he voted against the Civil Rights Act but for fair housing.
Well, he opposed the Civil Rights Act in 64. He didn't have a chance to vote against it because he was running for the Senate. What's important to me in this is, and I spent a lot of time on this question, is if in 1964 he opposed the Civil Rights Act, which we now know to be, and it was known then that it was a seminal moment in the long war against Jim Crow, how do you balance that historically with a man whose central character was always basically in the right place? And it's the fair housing vote in 68. When he was trying to win power, he was willing to oppose the Civil Rights Act. But once he had power and actually had a chance to vote on something, he voted the right way. He had gone to Vietnam over Christmas, 67 to 68. He came back believing that if you ask African-American soldiers to fight and die, you could not then tell them they couldn't buy a house in a given neighborhood. And so when the fair housing vote came up in April of 68, right after Dr. King's assassination, he voted for it. He went to Houston to face down a very angry meeting of constituents, quoted Edmund Burke saying that a representative is not simply a reflection of your will, but owes you his best judgment. And his best judgment was that fair housing was the right way to go.
Mm. And the trip to Vietnam, you write that maybe these were Barbara's words, and she was saying how her husband felt, came away believing that the anti-war elements in the U.S. were having a disproportionate influence over the North Vietnamese. Is that what he thought?
He did. He thought that he was trying to understand the demonstrations, to his credit, the student demonstrations. He was trying to understand the America of 1968, and was not as, you would think, one might think that he would just be like, those crazy kids, those long hairs. He wasn't like that. But he did see that that the North Vietnamese were drawing some sustenance and some support in a way from the well-publicized demonstrations, and thought that, and worked through as best he could his support for President Johnson on Vietnam in the face of the anti-war movement. He was not an unrepentant hawk by any means, but like a lot of Americans, and there is the reason the war took so long, he sort of, once we were in it, he thought, we were sort of in it, and he kind of muddled through in the same way that the country muddled through.
John Meacham is our guest this hour. His latest book is about George Herbert Walker Bush. Destiny and Power is the title, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Our phone number, we welcome phone calls. I hope some of you have had a chance to read the book. It is remarkable how long a life and how involved in public service and tragedy and meeting obstacles. And this gentleman, President Obama, John reminds us, called him when he got the Medal of Honor, a gentleman. And I think many people feel that way about him. And also maybe you're overlooking some of the substance of his life and his presidency as well. So if you want to join us, that would be a-okay. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Meacham is our guest. His book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls with Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Sounds like another fascinating program you got going here.
Thanks, Scott.
I would like to ask Mr. Meacham about the relationship between President Bush and Lee Atwater. I know that Lee Atwater, as he was at the end of his life, came to very much regret, or at least said he regretted, a lot of what he'd done in the campaign, particularly against Dukakis, and particularly with the Willie Horton House. And I'm just wondering if, because President Bush always seemed like somebody that would be kind of above the fray when it comes to that kind of thing, and yet, you know, there was Atwater doing this on his behalf.
John.
Sure. You know, Atwater was a tough operative. Bush hired him knowing he was tough and that he needed somebody who was good at the increasing attack culture, increasingly attack-oriented political culture. President Bush himself never expressed serious regret about the 88 campaign, at least to me. His basic view was that the furlough issue was a legitimate one, that the Pledge of Allegiance and the ACLU, all those issues added up to, in his view, support for his argument that Dukakis, Governor Dukakis, was outside the mainstream of American life. And so he had no apologies about drawing that contrast.
What about the Willie Horton ad?
Well, there depends on which one you mean. There's the ad that used the mugshot, which was by an independent group that the campaign denounced ultimately. There was a revolving door ad, which was more generic about the furlough program. You know, President Bush used Willie Horton's name a good bit, used the issue in speeches. But again, had no, you know, regretted that people thought he was being, he was playing a race card, but thought the issue itself was legitimate.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Scott, very much for your call. I didn't realize until reading your book that he did, and I'm wondering how serious this was, but he maybe fantasized or maybe he thought seriously about announcing to the nation at the end of 1991, I don't think I want to run again.
He did. After the Gulf War, he entered a kind of despondent state that was incredibly painful in many ways. There are a couple of things going on. One is the war itself had what he believed to be an inconclusive end, despite the fact that he had fought the mission he'd wanted to fight. But he did say in his diary, what kind of victory is it where the enemy is still left in charge? So that was part of it. Part of it also was his health. He had a thyroid condition that was quite serious, more serious than we thought, that affected his energy and his acuity. And he did. He thought maybe he would just go in and say, you know, I'm going to be a one-term president. Then his competitive juices would come back a bit. But he was an ambivalent political figure in the last 18 months of his presidency in a way that he was not in the first 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. You write in great detail about the Gulf War and the decision to go to war and what he went through, the walks that he took, the worry about American casualties, the decisions that had to be made, who he needed to listen to. You really feel the weight of the office when a president is making that kind of decision. What went into that decision, John?
Well, he honestly believed that he saw Saddam through the prism of World War II. He believed that if you didn't stop dictators early, you ended up paying a higher price down the road. And so after an initial skepticism about what kind of intervention, literally a day or so of his trying to figure out what kind of intervention made sense, he came to a resolution on Sunday, August 5th, 3 days after the invasion, was when he said, this will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait. And what the diary reveals is that one of the factors that changed through the weekend was that Bush was skeptical that Saudi Arabia would end up doing the right thing and standing up to Saddam, and that if Saddam were allowed to keep Kuwait, he would be a standing threat to Saudi Arabia, and that if Saddam were to go into Saudi Arabia, he would then have what Bush called a new world war. And so that was sort of his view of the Saudis was sort of new and surprising to me anyway. Mm. You know, and at that point, he decided that he would risk impeachment if he had to go to war to restore the territorial sovereignty of Kuwait. On five different occasions in his diary, he talks about his willingness to be removed from office if he has to. But he pretty much decided after that first weekend that that Saddam had to get out of Kuwait.
Was he prepared to use nuclear weapons?
I don't think so. He was, well, let me put it this way. The message went out that if Saddam were to use chemical or biological weapons, the United States would have no reservations about their response.
Mm-hmm.
So the Iraqis heard that as nuclear weapons. What is interesting is Dick Cheney did order up a small study to ask how many tactical nuclear weapons it would take to take out a division of the Republican Guards, if it came to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer came back, I think it was 17, which was sort of surprising to me. Would he have used a tactical nuclear weapon? He might have, but it certainly never reached a point where he was considering it.
Mm. And give us the details on this. Some years later, he's leading a small delegation to Kuwait, and he is to be the intended target of a car bomb. Tell us about what that was all about and what President Clinton's response to that incident was and what the president's was.
Yeah, it was early 1993. He was going over really to be honored as the liberator in many ways. There was a plot that was linked back to Iraqi intelligence take out the president and his party. President Clinton had a very emotional reaction, at least as he recalled it, believing that it was a terrorist act to potentially harm a president of the United States for what he had done while president. He launched the first military action Clinton ordered was in response to the attempt on Bush's life in early 1993. Bush was very restrained, very respectful of Clinton, was a little embarrassed, I think, by the attention, by the idea that he would be the cause of such a thing, but understood that Clinton had to do that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Jess is next in Mosinee. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
We've gone pretty far afield already without talking about the origins of the family money. I think there is a black sheep back there. It might be Mr. Bush's grandfather. Anyway, having a lot of money available to you gives you opportunities that a lot of money or little money wouldn't. How about it? Where did Grandfather Bush come up with the money?
Well, Samuel Prescott Bush was an industrialist in the Midwest. He ran a company called Buckeye Steel Castings. It was a railroad fortune, and he certainly did very well. And his son, Prescott Bush, became an investment banker on Wall Street, working with Brown Brothers Harriman. And so that's the origin of the fortune. The mother's fortune came out of the dry goods business in St. Louis, and then the investment world. G.H. Walker, the original George Herbert Walker, was not a big fan of the dry goods business and left his father's company to go into finance.
It really is, and you write about it at the beginning of the book, a fairly rarefied existence, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. No, it's unimaginable. I mean, his sister told me, President Bush's sister said it's unimaginable now, their lives. And there's no question that he had an incredibly privileged background, and it's unquestionable that he benefited throughout his life from being George Bush, no doubt about it. But my argument is, you know, there are lots of people who have means, who had not dissimilar life experiences, who chose a different path. And you can argue with what President Bush did, but I don't think anyone can convincingly argue that he wasn't driven at various points by his vision of what the national interest actually was.
Well, and that's exhibited pretty early on when, after Pearl Harbor, he's gone. He's ready to fight.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, and as I said, you know, he was one interested in getting to it earlier if he possibly could. You know, he's no saint. Let's be very clear here. There's not going to be a canonization proceeding by any means. But particularly in light of where we are now, his ability on a couple of critical occasions to put his understanding of the national interest ahead of his short-term political interest is a pretty remarkable thing. The chief example being he had pledged never to raise taxes, but in 1990, to get a budget deal that set up a pretty good decade, he broke that pledge knowing that the right wing would beat him about the head, which the right wing proceeded to do. It helped set in motion a series of events that brought in Pat Buchanan to challenge him in 1992, that brought in Ross Perot, who exacerbated the situation. But if you're a totally cynical political creature, you don't break that pledge in the way he did.
Mm-hmm. Buchanan... it's nice to be reminded of all of this when we're looking at what's going on now with the Republicans. Buchanan really was, Bush won, but I was amazed when you reminded us what Buchanan's poll numbers were in New Hampshire. He was going to town.
Oh, my God, yeah, 40%.
Yeah.
You know, remarkable. Gene McCarthy would have killed for that.
Right.
No, absolutely. And it was a sign of how weak Bush was politically, unquestionably. And the 1992 campaign was an unremitting disaster for Bush. And I think partly because he was living on borrowed historical time anyway. The 1988 election was anomalous in that we had not had more than 8 years of single-party White House rule since Roosevelt and Truman. And so to have a third Republican term in a row was already an extraordinary thing.
Right.
To have had 16 years would have been on a par with Roosevelt and Truman.
Mm-hmm.
And as great as Ronald Reagan and George Bush's experience was and the consequential nature of their presidencies, it wasn't Roosevelt and Truman.
No. Thanks, Jess, for the call. Marilyn sent us this email, wants to know how George Herbert Walker Bush felt about the decision of his son, George W. Bush, to invade Iraq.
He endorsed the decision. He said that in late 2002, when his son talked to him about it, he said, if the man, meaning Saddam, won't comply, then you have to do what you have to do. He was worried, had private anxieties about the invasion, which any sensible person would and did. But what doesn't fit the conventional narrative is that he, in fact, endorsed his son's course.
Mm-hmm. He did, though. Your book immediately made news with his comments about Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney.
Absolutely. He thought that Cheney and Rumsfeld had not served the president well, that they had exacerbated an overly hawkish tone to the administration. He held his own son ultimately accountable, though, and said that George W. should not have said axis of evil. He worried that, and these are my words, not his, but he worried that diplomacy and force were being seen as in competition with one another as opposed to complementary, and was very tough on Rumsfeld and Cheney, and broke, you know, a decade or more of silence about Bush 43, saying that that hot rhetoric is easy to get headlines, but it doesn't really solve the diplomatic problem.
Why do you think he broke a decade of silence and talked to you about it, John?
I think, I've spent a lot of time on this question, I think he wanted the historical record to be accurate. And, you know, you don't keep a very detailed diary as president if you don't care about history.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, this is what he believed. He thinks that historians will, if they look at him and his life from a fair-minded perspective, that they'll come away thinking he had accomplished a great deal. And I think that he wanted the record to show that these two big forces in his son's administration and his son at times had not conducted foreign policy in the way he thought it should be conducted. Mm-hmm. So he wanted the record to reflect that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a total repudiation of his son. It wasn't what a lot of commentators think. It's a very nuanced, carefully put point about rhetoric and tone and conduct, but almost more about style than substance, if you will. But he was worried about it. He was worried, particularly late in the son's presidency, that there were neoconservatives around Cheney who might want to widen the war on terror past Iraq, past Afghanistan, maybe, you know, try to pick a fight with Iran, bomb Iran. You know, this was the period in which these comments were made, and he thought that was unwise and wanted the record to show that.
John Meacham is our guest this hour. His book is what we're talking about, and it is titled Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. John received the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion, a few years back. Excellent book. He's executive editor at Random House, also the author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power. Let me look up all these other books he's written. He's quite a historian. American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship. And we're welcoming phone calls for him as we talk about the 41st president. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for John Meacham. Julie in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Julie.
I wanted to mention, I usually live in Bedford, Texas. And a couple of years ago, my husband and some friends drove down to College Station, where A&M is located, and also George Bush, H. Bush's library. And if anyone has the opportunity, it is just extremely well done, does a very good job of giving the history. And I came away realizing what a really great man he has been. I just didn't realize all the things he had done. It's a fascinating place to visit.
What do you think of it, John?
I'm a big fan, obviously, of College Station. The library there is first rate. The public displays are impressive. And so that's great to hear. You know, it's, I think what, again, without canonizing him, what's so remarkable is that through him, we can really see the story of American power in the 19th and 20th and even the 21st centuries. You know, he came out of the Gilded Age, industrial his family, you know, made a great deal of money and at a period when a lot of people were making money, new fortunes, a sense of energy about the country. He has a New England upbringing in Greenwich. You know, he has the World War II experience. He goes south and west as the center of gravity is moving south and west. You know, he's just a figure through whom we can see so much of our history.
Mm-hmm. And it is true, one of the things that you think about when reading about his life and what you've said during the interview is what has happened to the Republican Party in recent years, and some of us starting maybe with his son, at least recently, that it is just not a recognizable party, I would imagine, to Bush 41.
No, it's not. You know, and it started, you know, he struggled with this throughout. As early as 1963, Mrs. Bush wrote in her diary that the nuts will never love him, talking about the John Birch Society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did battle with the right-wing elements all through his career. Nothing new there. And it's you know, close to miraculous he became president, given his own internal differences with the right-wing base of the party that was becoming ever more conservative. I mean, the 1980 platform, here's something to chew on. The 1980 platform did not endorse the ERA and called for a pro-life amendment to the Constitution. The 76 platform had supported the ERA.
Hmm.
And it didn't have anything to do with, you know, the pro-life stuff. So it's a sign that, you know, the shift that Ronald Reagan ushered in, though he gave the right very little in the way of actual tangible results when he was president, but he did shift the tone in such a fundamentally conservative direction that, it's striking that Bush managed to negotiate that shift as long as he did.
Right.
And then the moment he broke Read My Lips, which broke with the supply side orthodoxy, the right said, see, this is what we told you. You know, mm-hmm. he was always this closet moderate Machiavellian thing. Mm. And now, you know, it's remarkable. I mean, we've gone from, you know, 25 years ago, a Republican nominee who didn't talk about himself very much to a Republican front runner who talks about little else.
Right. Absolutely. That's about all he talks about.
Yeah.
Let's go to 1980 for a moment and the story, because you talk about it in the book, and it's interesting. Ronald Reagan really not interested in George Bush to be VP. He really wanted Gerald Ford. So how did Bush get on the ticket?
Well, Ford did an interview with Walter Cronkite on the night, the last penultimate night of the convention, where Cronkite uses the phrase co-presidency. He says, so what you're really talking about is these conversations unfolded about whether Ford would leave retirement as a former president and return as vice president. And Ford didn't knock down the term. And Reagan was watching, suddenly realized that this was probably an unworkable situation. The talks kept going a couple more hours, but finally, after 11:30 on the penultimate night, Reagan finally realizes he needs someone from the moderate part of the party, though it was already shrinking. Ford would have been that proved too complicated, so he reached out to Bush. But it was at the very, very last minute.
Mm-hmm. And the Bushes made the transition from a Bush presidency to a Reagan presidency.
Just boom, yeah. Mrs. Bush walked up to Reagan actually the morning after the choice was made and said, "Don't worry about us, Governor. We're going to work our tails off for you." And Mike Deaver, a Reagan aide, said that was exactly the right thing to say to him right then.
I'm sure.
And they were incredibly loyal. I mean, they were to a fault. The Bushes were incredibly loyal, number two team to the Reagans.
We haven't talked about Barbara. We better do that before the hour is gone.
I know it. Yeah.
They met early on. He fell in love with her right away. They got married young. And how did she get the name Barr?
Oh, my gosh. I love that. Barr is not for Barbara. It had to do with a horse.
I know.
At Walker's Point, for some reason, and sort of lost in the mists of history, she started being named after this horse. Look, I don't think Mrs. Bush disagrees with this, but I'm not. I don't think he would have been president without marrying her. Mm. She kept the family together, body and soul, through all those years of his ambition, both in the oil business and in politics. She was an immensely popular first lady. We forget that, mm-hmm. Is just a remarkable American woman. You go back and look at this. She had that controversy at Wellesley when she was first lady. That the graduates, she was to be the commencement speaker and receive an honorary degree.
Yes.
And the graduates said, "Well, no, she's just famous for who she married."
Mm-hmm.
And she gave a really great speech. It's worth YouTubing. The kicker of which was, "I'm sure there is someone here who will follow me to the White House as the spouse of the president, and I wish him well." just brought down the house.
I'll bet it did. I'll bet. And he seemed smitten with her almost at first glance. They were really just kids, John.
Oh, they were. They were 17. Or 17 and 16, I guess. It was Christmas. It was the Christmas after Pearl Harbor. I mean, imagine what that must have felt like.
Really?
The Christmas dance at the Greenwich Country Club, probably within 3 weeks of Pearl Harbor. And then they married in January of 45. They had been married for 70 years. And I was giving
Goodness.
A talk recently. Yeah, I was giving a talk recently, and a man was sitting with his wife down front. When I said 70 years, he said, "Oh, my God." And I was thinking, "You've got a long ride home, buddy."
That's for sure. Or maybe another wife in the future, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
May not work out. She also suffered, which is totally understandable, and I'm wondering how her husband George dealt with this, into quite a depression after Robin died.
Oh, absolutely. And then again in the mid-70s. It was an interesting dynamic around the death of Robin. George Bush could not stand to see his daughter receiving shots or being treated, and so he would jump out of the hospital room when that was happening. Mrs. Bush was strong then, and then afterward, Mrs. Bush's resolve, just gave way after she lost her daughter, and so. And he was incredibly attentive and helpful. And as you probably know, people who lose a child sometimes drift apart. They actually got closer.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of jumping out, when did he get this idea to jump out of airplanes again?
Oh, it was in the late 1990s. He was at a parachute association meeting and just had this thought that, his initial jump had not been a clean one. He'd not done it exactly right when he bailed out of his plane. And so he wanted to do it again. And he's done it, I think, four or five times since then. it's one of the odder features of his post-presidency.
Did he ever ask you to join him?
He did not. And I think that's good because I probably would have said yes.
Would
and then
you?
The divorce would have been very expensive, I suspect.
I would imagine so. Well, I met him once back in 1991, I think. It was some conference in Milwaukee. And there was, that's the only face-to-face I've had with him, and you've had so many. But there is this description of him as a kind gentleman, I think, is so spot on because he is really a gracious man.
Absolutely. He has a quiet, persistent charisma, and people end up liking him without knowing quite why.
Well, that's a good thing to say, yeah.
And it's, he's, again, not a perfect man, but, for someone with that disposition to get to the presidency is unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did have, to borrow a phrase from Oliver Wendell Holmes, he had a first-class temperament. I think was uniquely suited to the foreign policy challenges of that era.
Mm-hmm.
Tiananmen Square, the fall of the wall, the end of the Soviet Union, first Gulf War. I mean, you couldn't really, mail order a president who better for that particular
right.
era. And and it may be that one term was what he needed,
Mm-hmm.
Not sure what he would have done with the second one. He wasn't sure either, and the American people intuited that, and so they they said, no, thank you. Yeah. We'll move on. And that's what politics is. And he was crushed by it, but he was never bitter about it.
John, thank you so much. Thanks for spending so many years writing this. I love reading presidential biographies, and you're a marvelous writer. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
John Meacham, the book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. John is an executive editor now at Random House. He received the Pulitzer for his 2008 biography of Andrew Jackson. He's also the author of Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Gospel, and Franklin and Winston. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Scotty Myers or Chris and Chris Molina for producing this program, and thanks to Scotty for on-air production. I'm going to be on some holiday time with family for a week or so, so the best of holidays to all of you, and I'll talk to you again in 2016. Isn't that something? Woo! News is coming up. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks.